listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And today, Brunch with Bernie. Get your calls ready. Our number 866-987-THOM. Senator Sanders is not going to be available on Friday, so we're going to have Brunch with Bernie here on Wednesday. And, yes, it's Wednesday, and we're live. And, Bernie, welcome to the studio.
Great to be with you.
Senator Sanders. I should be more respectful.
No, that's okay.
It's great to have you here with us. What are your thoughts on what's going on, this whole spectacle that we're seeing?
Let me there's so much that's going on. Let me just try to back it up a little bit. The first thing that people have to understand is the major political outrage of this whole process in terms of the government shutdown and the threat not to pay our bills has to do with John Boehner in the House, who is the Speaker of the House. You have 432 members of the House, 232 Republicans, 200 Democrats. In order to get a majority vote on the floor, you need something like 217 votes. So from day one, what Boehner has been saying is, we're only going to work within the Republican caucus. That means we need to get 217 out of 232 votes for anything. So 16 wild and crazy guys out there, and there are more than that, can sabotage any effort.
This is the old Hastert rule?
Well, I don't. The answer is a variation on it. But this is not God-given.
Yeah.
So from day one, this crisis could have been solved by simply having Boehner operate as the Speaker of the U.S. House and not the Speaker of the Republican Party. Okay? You got to understand that.
Yeah.
So when you got 20 or 30 extreme right-wing people, many of them who are sworn on a stack of Bibles, never to extend the debt ceiling, it's a virtually impossible task to do it. And they failed. They failed. Last night, they completely disintegrated. So that's number one. Number two, what people should know is that this tragedy, this nightmare, has already caused irreparable harm to this country. If you look at our standing in the international community, you know, we are presumably not only the largest economy, but the leader of the free world. And if you think that in Latin America, in Europe, in Asia, all over this world, Africa, people are not saying, what kind of country is this when they can't even keep their government open and they can't even pay their bills? And you have China beginning to become very assertive about this issue. Why is America the leader of the world and so forth and so on? It's irreparable damage in terms of our prestige and standing in the world community. Thirdly, in terms of people's faith and confidence in their own government, you got a million or so federal employees, hardworking people, who have not gotten a paycheck and are scared to death that they may not get a paycheck soon. These are people who have to pay their mortgages, their car loans, their college loans. They're like everybody else. They got to buy food. They got to take care of their family. Some of them are two people working, couples, both husband and wife, work for the federal government, causing tremendous anxiety for them. And then you have the tens of millions of people, veterans who absolutely depend upon their pensions, their VA pensions, their disability benefits, in order literally to survive. A lot of these folks don't have a lot of money. People on Social Security worried that if the government defaults, there is a reasonable chance that they may not get their checks in the immediate future. So tremendous anxiety. And faith in our own country. If you're a kid, you know, in high school, would be giving some thought to getting involved in the political process, paying attention. What are you thinking now about the United States government? You want to work for the government? I suspect, Tom, that at the end of the day, we'll have lost thousands of federal employees who say, look, I haven't gotten a pay raise in 3 years. I got furloughed. Now I'm, you know, sent home for several weeks without a paycheck. What do I want to work for the federal government for? I'll go out and get a job someplace else. And we're going to lose some of our best people, experienced people, and other people are not going to want to come. And this becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy for the right-wing extremists.
Right.
You destroy government, and lo and behold, government can't do much. So, all right, having said that, I'm going to vote for this agreement because obviously the alternative is catastrophic. We can't default. That will cause an international financial crisis. And we have to reopen the government for all the reasons that I gave. But I want everybody to understand that this agreement is a bad agreement in terms of the level of funding that will continue until January 15th. So we're looking at $988 billion, which is sequestration-level funding.
Right. So we're continuing austerity.
Exactly. Austerity for working families. That means major cutbacks for Head Start, major cutbacks for the Meals on Wheels program, major cutbacks for all kinds of programs that help low and moderate income people. And that's what we have. Now, as part of this agreement, and the agreement hasn't been finalized yet, so I'm talking a little bit before the reality is, there is another part of it which says that there will be a conference, probably the Budget Committee, on which I serve, which will then try to deal with future budget issues going into the future, what happens after January 15th. And here's the most important point to be made, I think, with regard to that. In America today, we are living in a nation where, as you've heard me say many, many times, the middle class of this country is disappearing. Tens of millions of Americans are working longer hours for low wages. Most of the new jobs being created are part-time jobs, are low-wage jobs. Poverty today at 46.5 million is at an all-time high. We've never had more people living in poverty than now. But in the midst of all of that, the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations are doing phenomenally well. So you have incredible income and wealth inequality. You have the top 1%, only 38% of the wealth of the nation, and the bottom 60%, only 2.3%. You have in the last few years 95% of all new income going to the top 1%. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So now we come into negotiations as to, okay, what kind of budget do we have in the future? Now, as you know, everybody knows, budget composes two parts. Number one is revenue. Number two is expenditures. Okay. What our Republican friends are saying is not only do we not want more revenue to come in, we want to give more tax breaks to very profitable corporations. One out of four corporations in America pay zero in federal income tax because they stash their money in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and other tax havens. And obviously, if we're serious about a responsible budget, we have to end that fiasco. The people who, you know, these corporations are going to have to stop paying their fair share of taxes. We have huge tax breaks for the fossil fuel industry and other industries, and that has got to be ended. So the debate that is going to take place, Tom, is as this committee is assembled, if this thing is passed, is that how do we go forward in terms of a way that is fair? Do we continue to bring austerity to the elderly, to the children, to the middle class, to the sick, and to the poor? Or do we ask the wealthiest people in this country who are doing just phenomenally well and the large corporations to stop paying their fair share of taxes? That is what the debate will be about.
Now, that's going to be between the time of this vote, and the New York Times just announced it's going to be an evening vote in the Senate. They just
plane to catch. I hope it is early evening.
Yeah. But you're talking about that debate. It's going to be after this vote in the Senate, the House, and the President signs this, and before the end of the year.
Right. The goal is for the committee to reach some agreement by December 15th. And
you think it will?
We'll see. I hope so. I mean, a lot of this is always has to do with how the American people respond. I mean, the Republicans now have kind of retreated on this whole thing because they are perceiving that the American people understand that it is totally crazy, that because they want to destroy Obamacare and defund it, that they bring the government to a halt. But I think in the same sense, if the American people understand that we don't, that we must not balance the budget on the backs of the middle class, we can win this fight.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders. It's Wednesday. Yes, it's Wednesday. We're 2 days early. We're doing Brunch with Bernie today. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Ralph in Grand Island, Nebraska. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sanders, could you explain what happened on October 1st when they changed that rule about bringing something up to on the Congress floor, only the Speaker could do it, or whoever he designated,
yeah,
or something of that.
Well, I think it was later than October 1st, actually, Ralph. I spent 16 years in the House, and I'm sure the House is very different today than it was then, and the rules are different. But among other things, I think you had two things. Number one, you had the ability of 218 members of the Congress to sign a discharge petition. So in other words, if the majority of members wanted a bill brought up and the Speaker or the Rules Committee did not want that bill to come forward, the way to go around them is to have a petition with 218. That's one thing. The second thing is that when the Senate, as I understand it, when the Senate passes legislation, members have the right to demand that the House deal with that legislation. What I think Boehner and his friends did is change that rule because they were scared to death. What we have known from day one is that if a halfway decent bill got to the floor of the House, you would have virtually every Democrat voting for it and 20, 30, 40 or more Republicans voting for it. It would pass. So the whole problem from day one, as I mentioned earlier, is that Boehner has refused to allow that to happen. So what they have done is now tightened up and said, the only way that we're going to vote is if the Speaker allows it rather than members coming up.
Yeah, that's bizarre. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing, Senator?
Good.
Thanks for doing your best to protect the American people. First, I have a rhetorical question. If you or Elizabeth Warren were president right now, what laws would you be able to get through this Republican-controlled Congress? And obviously the answer is zero. So my question is, shouldn't our number one goal as progressives be to fumigate the Congress of all Republicans? Let's educate people that if you want to lose your Social Security and Medicare, keep voting Republican. If you want more air and water pollution, keep voting Republican. More global warming, keep voting Republican. If you want to take a pay cut and lose your job, keep voting Republican.
Well, Paul, let me jump in because you've asked a very good question. Obviously, all of the media has been focused on this nightmare that we're currently experiencing with the government shutdown and the threat not to pay our bills and cause an international financial crisis. But Paul's point is a very good point. Tom, if you were to ask me, what has the United States Congress done since January? What have we done?
I think there's been a bunch of post offices named after Ronald Reagan.
Maybe that, and maybe we passed the helium bill.
Yeah.
We cannot, because of, Paul's point is well taken. I don't like the word fumigate, but Paul's point is absolutely right. Given the significant crises that we face as a nation, and that is a collapsing middle class, the need to rebuild a crumbling infrastructure, the need to make college affordable, the need to significantly improve our early childhood education, the need to deal with the planetary crisis of global warming, the need, bottom line, to expand the middle class rather than to see it shrink. Do I think we can accomplish that so long as the Tea Party controls the U.S. House? No, I do not.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this, 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's Wednesday's version of Brunch with Bernie. Bernie won't be around on Friday, so we're doing it today. And Matt in Chicago, Illinois, listening on that blowtorch of a station, WCPT. Matt, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, what happens when the rest of the world, when the economy decides we no longer want the U.S. currency to be the reserve currency of the world? What happens to the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy?
Well, thank you very much for asking that question, Matt. And that is why I began this show by saying that the damage done already is irreparable. Because there are more and more people all over the world who are looking at the United States and saying, no, you cannot be the foundation for the world's economy. We think you're too unstable. We think you have right-wing extremists who have shut down the government, threatening not to pay the bills, and you want us to follow you as the foundation of the world's economy. So I think, Matt's point is exactly right. These guys in the Tea Party are working hard, it seems to me, to make this country a second-rate nation. And that's really the simple truth. They don't want us to improve education. And I want to, if I can, use Matt's question, just go a little bit further. What I hope people understand is that the Republican resistance to Obamacare, and I voted for Obamacare, I voted for the Affordable Care Act, that I saw that as a modest step forward. We got 48 million people today without any health insurance. This would insure another 20 million people. It would put more money into disease prevention. I think there are mechanisms in it that would help us control the escalating cost of health care. But nobody thinks that this is the end all. We are the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right to a national health care program. And this obviously is not that. But what the Republicans were fearful of is that if Obamacare becomes successful and people get health insurance that otherwise did not have it, if people get a better deal than they currently have now, more cost-effective health insurance, then the right wing's dream of cutting back and cutting back will be detoured very significantly. Here is what these guys want, and maybe this is the most important point that has to be gotten out. What the Koch brothers and these other right-wing extremists want is not just defunding Obamacare. That's just the tip of the iceberg. They have a very different vision for society. What they want is to end Social Security, probably not immediately, but over a period of time, privatize Social Security. They want to end Medicare as we know it. And we saw the Ryan plan a couple of years ago, which voucherizes Medicare. It gives people an $8,000 check. And if you come down with cancer, good luck to you with your $8,000 check that will last 2 or 3 days. But that's their vision. Massive cuts in Medicaid. They want to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency so the corporations will be able to pollute our air and our water with impunity. Nobody but there to stop them. They want to end the Department of Education. They want to end the Department of Energy. And here's something that just blows me away completely. Right now, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, which is grossly inadequate to protect the millions and millions of people who are trying to get by on low wages. Do you know what the Republican solution to that is, Tom?
Do away with the minimum wage altogether.
Exactly.
Yes.
To eliminate the concept. And the broad issue here is this is their understanding of freedom.
Yeah.
Now, freedom comes, in this case, from the Koch brothers, who are worth $71 billion. So they're saying to the people of Alabama and Mississippi and all these states, you have the freedom not to have any health insurance for yourselves and your kid. And you have the freedom to work for $3 an hour. And you have the freedom to breathe polluted air or dirty water. What more can you want in terms of freedom? That is their message. Now, very few people in America understand that. So when we are dealing with this Obamacare, this is just one small part of a right-wing agenda, which is attempting through Citizens United and the ability to buy and sell politicians to transform our nation and to repeal virtually every piece of legislation passed in the last 80 years. And I'm not exaggerating, that protects working families, the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor.
Michael, in Imperial Beach, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Senator Sanders. Well, you sort of stole my thunder there. I saw your speech on the Senate floor today, Senator Sanders, about saying 1 in 4 corporations do not pay taxes at all. 1% made 95% of all the pluses in money this year. So I'm going to change ships. No one can deny that the U.S. has the most mind-boggling military in the world. So if the world un-Americanizes the American dollars, what will we do with our mind-boggling military, in your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you what we should do. I mean, I think we need a strong military, but we damn well do not need a military whose size is almost equivalent to every other nation on Earth. So you have all over Europe, countries are investing in healthcare. In many of these countries, college education is free. Parental leave is much, much more generous than anything that people in this country are thinking of. We're spending our money on the military, and they're providing for their kids and their elderly and for working families. So I think we need a strong military, but I think we can, in fact, make significant cuts in military spending.
Bernie, we have just a minute to the end. Do you see any of that coming about?
Well, you know, it gets back to the question I think was Matt asked a moment ago. so long as you have right-wing extremists controlling the U.S. House of Representatives, I am extremely pessimistic about passing significant legislation which addresses the many, many crises facing our country. Just using one example, what the scientific community tells us overwhelmingly is that global warming is the greatest planetary crisis that we face. And we have a major party, the Republican Party, that not only does not want to do anything to address the crisis of global warming, they think it's a hoax.
Yeah. In fact, we just released a movie, a 10-minute web-based video called Last Hours. I wrote it. I narrate it. I'm in it. George DiCaprio and Earl Katz produced it. And it's out there. It's free on YouTube. Anybody can find it at lasthours.org. And we're talking about how the geologists, not just the atmosphere scientists, but the geologists are saying there's parallels between now and the previous mass extinctions. This is serious stuff. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Brunch with Bernie on Wednesday. Back with more of Bernie with your calls in just a second. Sanders.Senate.gov. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Wednesday version of Brunch with Bernie. Bernie's not going to be around. He's not going to be here in town on Friday and available for us. So, Bernie, pick up more calls.
Let's do it.
Okay. Larry in Edmonds, Washington. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, Bernie, for all you do. And what I'd like to ask is, Wouldn't it be appropriate if everyone running for a legislature and being appointed to the Supreme Court had to pass a civics test, a test on the Constitution and Bill of Rights, equivalent to somebody applying for citizenship in the United States?
Well, it's an interesting concept, Larry. You know, I just, Tom, a couple of weeks ago, when the Supreme Court was doing oral hearings on that new campaign finance law. Was it McCutcheon?
And McCutcheon and the GOP versus
right,
FEC.
Right. And I went there. I've never been to an oral hearing before, and it was interesting. But here's what you got with the Supreme Court and campaign finance reform. When they passed 3 years ago Citizens United, they opened the floodgate of incredible sums of money into the political process. So they gave the billionaires in this country the opportunity to buy and sell politicians. And now they want to go even further. So when we talk about the Supreme Court, all that I would say, and I heard their discussion, and it really seemed unworldly. They really did not have a clue about what goes on in the real world. And where Citizens United is applicable today, where it's really having an impact today, is if you listen closely to the right-wing extremists in the House, what they are saying and have said in the last couple of weeks, they go to any so-called moderate Republican, they say, you want to vote to reopen the government and not destroy the Affordable Care Act, we're going to find a candidate to primary you, and that candidate will have all the money he or she needs from our multi-billion dollar friends. So you're already seeing, and that emboldens, you know, the right, the extreme right wing, it brings terror to, you know, moderate type folks who say, oh, my God, if I vote to open up the government and pay our bills, you know, some millions of dollars are going to come in against me. So that is what the Citizens United decision has already done. And these guys now want to give even more capability to billionaires to spend money on campaigns.
Reggie in Baldwin Park, California. Reggie, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I just wanted to say it's a real pleasure to talk to you. I've always wanted to ask you a plethora of questions, but today I actually have like a two-part statement that I would like you to elaborate on. And I honestly, personally, I think the Republican Party is being portrayed as standing up against a defund Obamacare. My question is, why are they not standing up to block the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Why did they not stand up against the National Defense Authorization Act or the Monsanto Act? Why are they, why is it being portrayed this way by our media? If you could elaborate on that, as well as your opinion on the fact that the United States of America is becoming increasingly more like a police state.
Okay.
Thank you, Reggie.
Okay, thanks for your good questions, Reggie. In terms of Obamacare, I'm going to get to your questions, but I wanted to say this. We did a hearing last week. It was really a good hearing. I am chairman of the subcommittee on primary health care. And I brought in some real experts. And I said, if we were to defund Obamacare and deny some 20 million Americans the opportunity to get some form of health insurance, how many people would die? Die. What most Americans don't know is that we are losing about 45,000 people every single year, according to a Harvard study, because they don't get to a doctor when they should, and they don't get to a doctor when they should because they have no health insurance or their deductibles or copayments are too high, and they just don't have the money to get to a doctor. So they get sicker and sicker, and then they finally crawl into a doctor's office, and the doctor says, guess what? Your situation is now terminal. Why didn't you come in here 6 months ago? That's the reality. If you were to deny health insurance to the 20 million people who would be covered under the Affordable Care Act, there's no question, no one can say exactly how many, thousands and thousands of people would die who otherwise will stay alive. That's number one. Reggie's point, though, focuses on what the NSA is doing, and every day you pick up the paper, you see another outrage. And it's not simply that virtually every telephone call made in this country, the record of that, not the content of it, but the fact that you made that call is on file with the NSA, but we're learning more and more that the NSA and other agencies are getting into emails, getting into websites. It is very, very, very frightening. And it is an issue. I mean, when we talk about how in the last number of weeks the great mission of Congress is to pay our bills and keep government open, these are exactly the kinds of issues that we should be talking about. Do we really believe in freedom? Do we really believe in privacy? Or do you think the United States government should be able to check on your emails, the websites that you visit, and your telephone calls? Is that really what we mean by a free society? To my mind, that is not what we mean by a free society. And I'm working with other senators to significantly curtail what the NSA and the other intelligence agencies do. Terrorism is a serious problem. We have to protect the American people. But you can do it without undermining the basic constitutional rights of the people of our country, and that's what we've got to fight for.
John, in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Sanders. I only wish that other senators that are in the chamber, if you would do this and speak openly with the people. This past, the other day, one of the senators had a meeting with several business people that are in the banking, the travel industry, and they were talking about that this shutdown is only just a pinprick to them, according to the GOP, but according to them, it's not a pinprick. This is a major disaster to them. It seems that Republicans are good at manufacturing problems more than resolving them. So what do you feel about that meeting? Do you have you reviewed it, and how do you feel about it?
Well, John, this is what we do know. We know, and there was, I think, a piece either in the Washington Post or the New York Times today, that this two-week shutdown is already having a very significant impact on the economy. It is already resulting in jobs being lost. There's no question that it's going to impact our GDP. So anyone who tells you that this shutdown has not impacted our economy is just not telling you the truth. And obviously, if the Congress were not to pay our bills, bills that we have already accumulated for the first time in the history of this country, the word that economists are using is catastrophic. That in a global economy, no one knows exactly what will happen, but it could be disastrous. In worst case, it could drive this country, drive the world into a depression or a significant recession. So anyone who tells you that this is not real, not to mention that there are a million workers in this country who do not have a paycheck, have not received their paychecks, and are unable to go out and pay their bills. So this has already caused significant economic problems, and it will only get worse if we don't address it today.
Dawn in Greeley, Colorado, listening on AM 760 out of Denver. Dawn, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Bernie, I would like to ask you, what are the chances of anyone charging these people with sedition or treason? I'm just watching all this happen, and it seems like such traitorous behavior in Congress. It's maddening.
It is maddening. I don't think, you know, you're going to be, I mean, the way to win this thing is just to defeat these guys politically. And by the way, I think we now have an opportunity to do that. I think as anybody who follows this stuff knows, the Republican brand name now is almost as low as it has ever been. All kinds of people are turning away from them. Independents are turning away from them. Moderates are turning away from them. And I believe that we do have an opportunity to take back the House of Representatives. And I think that, as I mentioned earlier, I just do not believe how this country is going to address any of its serious problems so long as these right-wing extremists control the House. And I think there's got to be a lot of energy and organization at the grassroots level, money, to make sure that Republicans do not continue to control the House. So.
Frank in Cambridge, Mass., you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. First of all, I'd like to say that Bernie Sanders could be the new rap senator, because I was listening to Topsy Part 2 in the background, and he was talking, and they just all of a sudden just jived. I could hear his message a lot clearer. But what my original question was, I saw this morning some news, well, this is mainstream media news, that Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee and Ted Cruz are going to stand up against something that's going to, they're going to block a bill from going. Now, I understand that senators have a
Frank, we just have 30 seconds.
All right, Frank, let me respond. The latest that I've heard is that is not the case. The absurdity of rules in the Senate that if Senator Cruz or Senator Lee or I wanted to go down and say, I object to a unanimous consent proposal, which in this case would bring up the legislation, right, which would end the government shutdown and the possibility of default. If I went there and said, I object, or Cruz went there and said, I object, it would take days for that bill to reappear. My understanding, you know, what I last heard, I don't know if the world has changed, is Cruz indicated he would not do that.
Yeah, that's where it stands. And a reporter asked him, well, what did you get out of this? And he said, I got 2 million names on a petition. And he's raised $700,000. So anyway, we'll be back. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can check out his Facebook page as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more Senator Sanders in just a second. And welcome back. Senator Sanders with us. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Steve, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. I heard your previous answer on the on the part about the trees in there and stuff, but didn't these congressmen take an oath there up, pull the Constitution and to enforce the laws? And I believe that their actions violated that Constitution. So are they going to be held accountable for violating their oath of office?
And who's going to hold them accountable? Do you think the Speaker of the House is going to hold them accountable? Do you think the Supreme Court is going to hold them accountable? It's not going to happen. And, you know, I think the argument is that, to my mind, what they have done in the House is to hijack the political process. They lost the election. This is what they campaigned on. Their candidate for president lost by 5 million votes. In the Senate, they lost 2 seats. In the House, they lost seats, and the Democrats got more than 1 million votes than they did in the House of Representatives. They lost the election. And essentially what they have done is said, okay, well, yeah, we lost the election. The program we brought forth was soundly rejected by the American people. It doesn't matter. We now have the leverage of bringing the government to a halt, shutting down the government, not paying our bills, and we're going to get our way. So, you know, what they are doing is something at a level that I have never seen before. It is an absolute outrage, and I think the American people understand that, and it's important that they pay a political price for that.
And that's next November. Al in Rome, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hey.
My basic question is, when will the VA put the priority on the patients instead of corporations, and how long will it take?
Al, you'd have to go into that in a little bit more detail. I think in general, the VA provides quite good health care to the veterans of this country. Some 6 million or so veterans access VA health care. They have a comprehensive approach. They have a lot of very good doctors and nurses and good staff. It is far from a perfect system, and you're never going to have a perfect system when you have 152 medical centers and 900 community-based outreach clinics. But in general, I think they do a good job. And I'll tell you, Al, what we're trying to do. We're trying to expand VA eligibility to make it easier for veterans who today are not eligible to access the VA to come into the system. We're also trying to expand VA healthcare to include dental care as well. Dental care is a huge issue in this country. A whole lot of people can't afford to get to a dentist, including many veterans. So we're kind of working on that issue as well.
So, and you're the chairman of the
yes.
of the Veterans Committee in the Senate. Do you see that backlog starting to resolve itself, or did that
get
worse from the government
shutdown? Well, guess
what
just happened? The answer is yes and no. Yes, the VA was making significant progress in addressing the backlog and dealing with the transition of going from a paper system to a digital system. But now, because they've had to furlough many, many thousands of workers, they're going to lose that progress. Now, we don't know exactly what the numbers are, but certainly their progress has been slowed down.
So we get Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz out. Well, don't get me started. I'll rant about it later. This is not a good way to treat it. We'll be back. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls here on Brunch with Bernie. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Senator Sanders in the studio with us today, taking your calls. Brenda in Woodlawn, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. And thanks, like I said, everybody else for having a show like this. I really appreciate it. And I am from the district that Marsha Blackburn is in. And for anybody who might want to know, we are ashamed of her, and she does not represent our district. It's not her district. It's ours. But anyway, back to why I called. We were talking earlier about the minimum wage, and I was thinking that it's like they almost couldn't have planned it any better, because the more hours that people have to work, the less time they have for education, the less time they have for taking care of their families, which end up in daycare and nowhere else, the less time they have to actually get on the internet and listen to shows like this and do their own research. If they couldn't have planned it better if they wanted to dumb down our country.
Well, Brenda, I'm sorry, did you want to ask a question? Because you make a very important point.
Yeah, I wanted to see if that's an honest thing of what they might, if what they're, if like I said, it's almost like they planned it, you know?
Are they really
that devious? Do they really care that little about this country?
Yeah, I think they do care that little about this country. These guys have a vision, is that I think what they are aiming for is a society where a handful of billionaires who can spend unlimited amounts of money in elections. If you are the Koch brothers and you have $71 billion, what do you think it means that you spend a few hundred million or $500 million on a bunch of elections around the country? That is like $20 to you. It just doesn't matter. So what they want to do, and their ultimate goal, is to end all restrictions on campaign finance. So the day will come where the United States Congress will look like these NASCAR riders, where they'll have these patches, you know?
Yeah, that was my suggestion in my book, Rebooting.
Yeah, so some guy will walk around. I am sponsored by Goldman Sachs.
Right.
I am sponsored by Bank of America. Hey, General Electric bought me.
Yeah.
That's where you are moving. And Brenda's point is that meanwhile, while you have that reality, what's the other reality? The other reality is that people are living under incredible stress. They're working longer and longer hours, often for lower wages. They got to take care of their parents. They got to take care of their kids. Do you really think they're going to have the time to sit down and go to political meetings and get involved in the political process? Brenda's absolutely right. They're not. People are exhausted. They're tired. They're disgusted. And our friends, the Koch brothers and these other groups will get their way and control the political, and not only the political process, but the economy of America.
Yeah, and average people aren't running for Congress anymore. I think it was the 2010 or 2012 election was the first time that more than half of all the members of the House of Representatives were multimillionaires.
Yeah, you're seeing that as well. And because of Citizens United, I mean, it was bad before, it's worse now. If you're a normal human being, you know, middle-class person who's concerned about your country, your state, you want to run for office, do you really want to go out and spend half of your time raising the extraordinary sums of money that you need to try to win? Yeah. Meanwhile, your opponent, you know, will have the Koch brothers pouring in huge amounts of money into their campaign. A very dismal situation.
Dave in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. What an honor to speak with you, gentlemen. My question is that how can and I think Mr. Sanders is a great hope, and I agree with just about everything he says. In light of that, how do progressives re-educate the people who are kind of brainwashed by the right-wing propaganda and somewhat justifiably suspicious of large government programs? How can we change some
minds? Dave, that's a great question. That is a great question. And, you know, one of the things that I'm upset about is that my schedule called for me today to be in Mississippi, to be talking to some of the folks in Mississippi, tomorrow in Alabama, then in Georgia, and then in South Carolina. And the reason I'm going down south and holding these meetings is precisely to do what you are talking about, is to begin to talk to people who do not often have the opportunity to hear a progressive message. And here is the good news in the midst of all of that. There was a poll a couple of years ago, Tom. They asked Tea Party people, people who identify with the Tea Party, whether they thought we should cut Social Security. And you know what they said? Overwhelmingly, no.
Sure.
Right. So you got a lot of people out there who really don't even know what the Koch brothers are about, what this agenda is about. They are angry. And people have a right to be angry. And what the billionaires have done is taken this anger and focused it in a way that becomes self-destructive to the people who are involved. So, and you know, and race plays a role in it with Obama as well. But what the good news out there is, if you asked the people in any state in this country, should we cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? Every poll that I have seen is people are saying, no, of course we do not. Should we make college more affordable? Yes, we should, say the people. Should we ask the wealthiest Americans and the largest profitable corporations stop paying their fair share of taxes? Yes, we should. So in other words, the agenda that we believe in of creating jobs, of protecting the middle class, is the agenda that people all over this country believe in. Unfortunately, there are many states, you know, and Dave makes this point, where people are not hearing that message. How many people know, for example, that the United States is the only nation in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people? Tom, you tell me.
I would guess most people don't know that.
I think most people don't know it. They don't know that the health care system or the non-system that we have is the most wasteful and bureaucratic and expensive system in the world. They don't know that. Who's telling them? Who is telling them that? So what we need to do, as Dave indicated, is we need to develop a strong grassroots network. And the goal is to make sure that working people do not vote against their own best interests. To have people actively involved so that their kids will lose health insurance. I mean, that's pretty crazy stuff. Or not be able to go to college.
It's reverse populism. It's like turning it into a character.
It's like banging yourself on the head.
Yeah.
What is the sense of that? Meanwhile, the Koch brothers laugh all the way to the bank. They're worth $70 billion. They got more tax breaks. And working people say, that's great. And we're going to take away my own health insurance.
Yeah, that's crazy. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
I truly appreciate it. All these years. We'll be back with, the news of the day. I got to tell you about fast food giants making billions while their workers are taking billions in welfare benefits. We're subsidizing the fast food industry. We'll get into that right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So while your attention was elsewhere, no, seriously, what the last 3 weeks now, we have been all paying attention to this so-called budget standoff, or, you know, the government shutting down and all this kind of stuff. What we haven't been talking about is this new model of capitalism, which has taken hold of America as a consequence of Reaganomics. Now, the two things apropos of that. The first is Ted Cruz. Somebody asked him, well, what did you get out of this budget, you know, shutting down the government? And he said, we saw, first of all, millions of American people rising up across this country, over 2 million people signing a national petition to defund Obamacare. In other words, he harvested 2 million email addresses. He also took in $797,000 in contributions, Ted Cruz, as a result of this shutting down the government. And the Heritage Action Fund, the Heritage Foundation's PAC, they took in $330,000 so far. And with that 2 million email addresses, they'll be able to go back every month and say, hey, how about another $10? $10 from 2 million people? If all of them gave $10, and some will give 20 and some will give nothing, so let's say that they all gave on average $10. Because some will give 200 and some will, you know, and maybe a 10 will give nothing. $10 a person, 2 million addresses, that's $20 million a month that Ted Cruz could be bringing in as a result of having shut down our government. So he shuts down the government. And meanwhile, 2,033 civilian employees were laid off. These are people who, like, you know, man the food shops around the national parks, or people whose business depends on tourism around the Statue of Liberty, that kind of thing. 883,392 actual government employees got laid off. $206 million worth of supplemental food assistance to women, infant, and children in severe need. These are the desperately poor and high-risk children. $206 million worth of food was not given to them over the last 2.5 weeks. $2,982,000,000 in unpaid salaries. So that's what happened. But this new model of capitalism, the thing I really wanted to riff on, this was invented in large part, I would submit to you, by Walmart and the companies that were following the Walmart model. Now, I don't know if Walmart invented it, but they certainly have perfected it. And we used to think this was just a Walmart problem. And here's how the business model works. We will do business in a way that will make a profit for us, but it will also generate some costs. But the public will pay for those costs. So tax dollars will pay for the costs that are created by our doing business the way that we do. And we get to keep all the profits. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there is not a good name for this kind of capitalism, which is a real shame, because this is the new American capital model. Now, it's been going on for a long, long time. You know, you've heard me a million times say, you know, the mission of business is it internalize profits, externalize costs. Keep the profits in the company, put the costs on the people. And you could go all the way back to John Rockefeller's oil wells in Ohio in the 1880s. Standard Oil in New Jersey in the 1890s. I mean, to this day, the Koch brothers refining oil in Michigan and Chicago and refining the tar sands crude and having, ending up with these huge piles of waste that when the wind blows just go downwind into largely poor African-American communities and pollute the air. They keep the profit, we get the trash. But the way that Walmart did it was Walmart keeps the profit and they pay their employees so little that their employees are literally impoverished. They literally are living below or at or near to the poverty line. And as a consequence, their employees are eligible for food stamps and housing assistance and heating assistance in the winter and Medicare, or Medicaid rather. And so we are subsidizing their employees. They pay their employees $7, $8, $9 an hour. It's not enough to live on. You really need, you know, $10, $11, $12 an hour to live on. I mean, $12 an hour is what the minimum wage was in 1968. And back in 68, most of the people working in for the minimum wage were young people just entering the job market. So to make up that difference between the $9 an hour that they're paid and the $12 or $13 or $14 or $15 an hour that it actually costs to live, people are getting benefits from the government. Which means you and I are subsidizing the workers at Walmart. And we've seen where, you know, one study was done that showed that just one Walmart store basically sucked up about $1 million a year in benefits for its employees. So every Walmart store is costing us, the taxpayers, say $1 million a year. Well, here comes this new study. This is just amazing. This is the University of California Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. Ken Jacobs is the spokes guy for this. And he says that the wages of America's fast food chains are so low. Now, this is just the fast food industry. I'm not talking about Walmart anymore. This is what I'm pointing out is that this is spreading, this form of the vampire capitalism. Right, and they have their fangs into the bloodstream of we the people, into our tax dollars. America's fast food chains are paying so little to their employees that their employees used, and now they looked at the years 2007 through 2011, so this is a 4-year study, good solid study, $7 billion. A year that you and I are paying in taxes that gets shifted to the workers of these fast food restaurants. They said the 10 chains, this is the National Employment Law Project found, the 10 chains with two and a quarter million workers, this is about a 60% of the no benefit business model, they call this. Just these 10 chains, this is McDonald's, Yum Brands, which is Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, KFC, Subway, Burger King, Wendy's, Dunkin' Donuts, Dairy Queen, Little Caesars, Sonic, and Domino's. Okay, just those 10 companies have 2.5 million workers. Their workers took $3.8 billion in benefits, public benefits. We subsidized those companies, those 10 companies, to the tune of $3.8 billion. The executives at those companies made more than $53 million in compensation, and $7.7 billion was paid in dividends and buybacks to their shareholders. So they show a $7.5 billion profit, and we kick in $3.8 billion so that their employees can stay alive and come to work every day. This doesn't even count the other, you know, I've always talked about, you know, the cost of providing a workforce where people can actually spell and read and write and add and run an addy machine and, you know, public roads that they can drive to work on and all of these things that these corporations should be paying for that they're by and large typically not, because they figure out these tax dodge schemes, tax avoidance schemes, before they come into town and they say, oh yeah, we'll create jobs here, but give us, you know, 10 years no taxes, or give us some free land or something like that. Do you have an idea for a name for this kind of capitalism? I'm trying to name it, and I need a name.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So vampire capitalism is where I started, but there's got to be it's got to be a better name. Anyhow, we'll be back with your thoughts on this. Stick around. Welcome back. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good talking to you today. I think they showed what they're really up to is that they're trying to destroy the government. And when the government's destroyed, there's a void. And the corporations are going to step in and fill that void.
Yes.
And it's exactly what you're talking about. A corporate takeover of the American way of life.
Yep.
And we stood up to them, and we showed that they don't have the intestinal fortitude to shoot the baby they took hostage.
Yeah.
Because it would destroy their buddies.
Well, I think they ultimately backed down. Because actually, I think that they reached a point where the serious people behind the Tea Party, the billionaires behind the Tea Party, said, hey, wait a minute, we've got billions of dollars at stake here. We really don't want to crash the U.S. economy. We just want to shake it a little bit to assert our power.
We want to take it over.
They're in the process of doing that.
And they have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And that upsets me.
Yeah.
I don't want them in my government.
I would prefer that they weren't either. But the other thing to keep in mind is that there's only 30 or 40 of these teabaggers, Tea Party guys, in the House of Representatives, and there's only two of them in the Senate. And what's amazing to me is what Bernie pointed out at the very beginning of the show, which I did not know, which was that John Boehner has made it his policy to only pass laws that can be passed entirely by Republicans. And he's got 230-some-odd Republicans, and he needs 217 votes. So that means that if 25 or 30 of his Republicans say, no, I won't go along with that, it doesn't pass. John Boehner will not bring it up for a vote, which means that 30, 35, 40 people Tea Party caucus is able to literally hold the entire country hostage because of the way that John Boehner has been running the House of Representatives. And that is bizarre to me. I mean, that's not just partisanship or hyper-partisanship. That's un-American. That's fundamentally un-American to say that the other political party, you know, we're never going to bring legislation to the floor that might pass if it requires any Democratic votes whatsoever. That the other political party doesn't exist.
When he took over the speakership, he said he was going to go by the Hastert rule.
Well, this is beyond the Hastert rule. I mean, the Hastert rule is that you don't bring something to the floor unless a majority of your caucus agrees with it. So if he's got 230 members of his caucus, he'd have to have 115 Republicans agree with it. There's 115 Republicans in all probability who would have voted not to shut down the government after the first day that it was closed.
Yeah.
So he's gone beyond what Hastert did. Now you've got the Boehner rule. And the Boehner rule is that something doesn't come to the floor for a vote unless at least 217 Republicans are willing to vote for it. Which means that anything that the Democrats want to do will never happen. And even the things that the moderate Republicans want to do, the Eisenhower Republicans, the Reagan Republicans want to do, that isn't going to get done. The only things that are going to get passed are things that the Tea Party Republicans agree with. And it's absolutely amazing. Corky, thanks for the call. Always nice to hear from you. We'll be back here on the Tom Hartman Program. What would you call this capitalism? This new form of capitalism that relies on you and me to subsidize their workers and pay their taxes and everything else, and they keep all the profits. We'll be back. Think about this. If you were standing in the midst of an extinction, is it possible you could be completely unaware of it? Underground, underwater, and below the ice, a time bomb is ticking. Scientists are seeing the evidence. Runaway climate change could be closer than we think. Go to lasthours.org and share the video with your friends now to help get this important message out right away. Welcome back to the Bear, a place where we dare to ask, is McDonald's a person? No, I don't think so. They're actually, Shano said, parasitic capitalism. I like that. They're a parasite. Yeah. Could that be? Is that our name? Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, you know, the teabaggers are a kind of a special crowd. You know, when they're singing Amazing Grace, you know, they are 2 Timothy 3:5. You know, having a form of godliness, but denying him, okay, or the power of God. The cuts in food stamps, Social Security, Medicare, they even won't fund, you know, work projects they refuse to fund. They're all things that benefit their social strata, okay, the Bush tax breaks, Romney only paying 14%. You know, this is 2 Timothy 3. The end days will be perilous times. People will be lovers of self more than lovers of good. Lovers of money more than lovers of good. Heady and high-minded. That's Medicare and Social Security. We had that for 60 years, but now it's...
So, Gary, are you suggesting that the existence of the Tea Party is evidence that we're living in the biblical last times?
Yeah. When you put that together with 2 Peter 3, you know, the world will end by heat and the elements will melt in the heat, you know, you've got a full picture.
And there's global warming.
Yeah, global warming. I got it on good authority. You know how much...
Wait a minute. That was 2 Peter what?
2 Peter 3.
I'm going to have to look that one up, but that's somehow that one slipped right by me. Gary, thank you for the call. Interesting premise. I think every generation has been able to figure out that they live in the end times ever since the, you know, Revelation was written. But interesting premise. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, well, the Koch brothers, you know, one of their big industries is cattle ranching. Mm-hmm. Here in Montana, they own about 300,000 acres. Now, a big cattle ranch in Montana is about 6,000 acres. But what with their cattle ranch total... They have it in Montana and Kansas and in Texas, over 425,000 acres. They only hold deed to about 200,000. The rest is all leased. And the vast majority of that is leased from the federal government.
The Koch Brothers Ranch you're talking about?
And forest land. Now, the interesting thing about it, if you run your cattle on private land, you pay anywhere from $15 to $20 a month per cow and calf.
Mm-hmm.
That's called an animal unit. If you run it on BLM land, forest land, you know how much you pay?
No.
$1.35.
Whoa. So the Koch brothers are making a fortune on their cattle ranch because it's on public land. So we're subsidizing the Koch brothers' cattle ranch? Really?
Huge. Huge. They would pay $15 to $20 an animal unit per month on private land. They pay $1.35 on our land.
Wow.
And, you know, and
where did that start? Yeah. Does that go back to the Reagan administration and old, the crazy guy who said that he was giving everything away because Jesus was coming back?
No, it goes back to 1976. You know, and my family used to be ranchers, my granddad was, and there's a lot of poor people that, it's a welfare program, and a lot of poor ranchers need it.
Mm-hmm.
Billionaires don't need that, you know. And
right. So we should means test.
It, but they get blocked all the time. It's insane that's welfare to these ranchers.
Right. So if you want to means test welfare, let's means test grazing on public lands.
Exactly.
And if it's Michelle Bachmann gets farm subsidies, right? I mean, you know, if you're a wealthy family that has the kind of farm where you can get public benefits, good idea. Ken, thank you for waking me up on that one. Warren in Kirkland, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM. Hey, Warren, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I know you know the name of the bill that was passed in 86 that started paying CEOs with dividends. And maybe it's just you should call the capitalism, name it after them. Do you remember who that was?
No.
Darn it. It's funny if you go to Google Finance and you look at right when all the companies started getting paid dividends and all their, you know.
Right, yeah. No, this was during the Reagan administration. They changed the rules. It used to be that you couldn't compensate executives with stock options. And then this theory came along that, boy, that was a strange noise. This theory came along that the executives should think in terms of, their values should align with those of stockholders, which is really a bad idea, actually. Their values should align with those of the community and of the company and of the employees, but instead they put them with the stockholders. But I'll have to track that down, Warren. Warren, thanks a lot for the call. Brian in Havre, Montana. Hey, Brian.
Yeah, hi, it's Haver.
Haver, thank you.
I just had a question. I think the Patriot Act is still enacted, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
This just keeps bothering me, and can't we use the Patriot Act against this? I mean, I think one of the rules was if you form a group of people that are their end result is destroy America, they can arrest them, but I don't know if it's stupid.
Well, they're not destroying us. They're just taking all our money. I mean, you got these fast food companies taking $7 billion a year.
I'm talking about the Tea Party.
Oh, you're talking about the Tea Party in Congress.
Yeah.
I don't think that they. I mean, let's set aside the bumper stickers kind of talk. I believe that most of these guys, most of these Tea Party guys, there might be a few who are just, hey, you know, the Koch brothers will pay me a lot of money. I'll get rich someday. I'll be a lobbyist. You know. But I think most of these guys actually believe this stuff. They actually believe that if people get unemployment checks when they are laid off in a bad economy, that that's going to turn them into lazy bums. And therefore, there shouldn't be unemployment compensation. That if people get health insurance from the government, that they'll start going to their doctor every day for the fun of it. You know, they have so little contact with the real world and with reality, and they've never had contact with real poverty, even American poverty. And as a consequence of that, they buy these slogans. And it's really a sad thing. It's really a sad thing. Brian, thank you for the call. We've got to come up with a name for this. Parasitic capitalism. Parasitic capitalism I like a lot. David has some thoughts on Walmart externalities. We'll be back with more of your thoughts on this right after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So these fast food companies make $7 billion in profits, and $3.8 billion we subsidized. What do you call that? Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Dennis Prager was our guest yesterday, and a listener notified me today in email that Dennis took clips from our show yesterday and played them on his show today. And kind of, you know, saying, see, this is what the left is like. And what I find really interesting about this is, and particularly for those of you who listen to my debate with Dennis, I mean, you know, we talked for a half hour in this hour. I think it was this hour yesterday. Was that I would bet that any of Dennis's regular listeners, any you know, Tea Party listeners, would probably think that Dennis beat me up yesterday, that he won. And I would guess that probably most of my listeners would think that I made some pretty good points and that he didn't come out so well. And I think that that's unfortunate. That we have become so siloed. You know, some of us only watch MSNBC or only watch Free Speech TV and never watch Fox. And people who watch Fox never watch MSNBC or Free Speech TV. Only listen to right-wing talk radio. Only listen to left-wing talk radio. And now it's getting even worse, by the way, because the Google machine and the newspapers now, the New York Times is starting to do this. I'm noticing when I look at the recommended for you stories on my New York Times app on my phone, mine are different from my wife's. Because I'm looking at the stuff that progressives would typically read, but she's thinking as a producer. So she's looking at the right wing stuff because she's thinking, oh, I'll get this guest on for Tom to debate. And so her New York Times profile is quite different from mine. And so they're feeding her different stories. They're feeding, you know, her the stories. It appears. I mean, this is how it just, this is the only possible explanation I can come up with, is that increasing, and it's not just the New York Times. I don't mean to pick on the New York Times. I think, you know, Google does this. Right across the board, everybody is trying to figure out a way to know what you want so they can deliver it to you. And you get nothing else. And I'm not sure that's such a good thing for America. I think that I told you yesterday, Louise and I we didn't have a TV show last night, so we had our first date in a long, long time. and we actually got a hotel room here in town. Get away from the cats for the night. It was, you know, we big bathtub. I mean, you know, we had a great time. And went out to a nice restaurant. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, in the hotel, and then in the morning, they put a newspaper under your door, and it was USA Today. And I'm like, and I have not read USA Today in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. I don't know. It's been a long, long time. I used to read it when I would travel because it would always be under my hotel room doors. And I was just astounded by the, what I would call a right-wing bias throughout USA Today. No, you know, there wasn't a single story in there that said that John Boehner could have ended the shutdown of the government on day one, or that he had changed the rules, or any of that stuff. You know, it's like it was all covered like, you know, team sports stuff. There's something not right about that. I mean, on this program, I try to bring on conservatives as often as possible to at least give you a sense of what the other side is thinking, so you know what's going on in the brains of people who disagree with us politically or disagree with me politically. You may, maybe you do. I don't know. But, and I think that's a healthy thing. And to model a way to talk back to that in a, you know, in a way that doesn't leave blood on the floor, you know, that's just, you know, is reasonable. But most of our media doesn't do that, and it concerns me. Anyhow, Peter in Voorheesville, New York, you have a name for this kind of capitalism where they make seven, in the case of the fast food industry, they made $7 billion in profits, and they took $3.8 billion, or their employees were subsidized to the tune of $3.8 billion in welfare benefits?
Yeah, I sure do, Tom. I think the man who started it, he should wear its name, Reaganhood Capitalism. Rob from the poor to give to the rich.
Reagan.
Tax rate from 74% in 81 after he got into 28%. A two-thirds reduction in taxes. 32 days later, we're bankrupt. And as far as the fast food industry, it reminds me of the farmer tried the same thing in the 30s. He was lamenting the loss of his mule. He couldn't understand it. He said, I can't understand it. I finally got that mule to work without feeding it, and it up and died.
Amazing. That's a great. I love this Reaganhood capitalism. Peter, Shano says that you're gonna get a free book here today. I'm gonna put you on hold, and Danielle, he's on line seven. Danielle, and Danielle will find out which book you'd like. We have these are all books I wrote: Unequal Protection, Screwed, Rebooting the American Dream, Cracking the Code. I think that's all we've got extra copies of. I think it's just those four books. But anyhow. Thank you for that suggestion, Peter. Oh, by the way, our Twitter, Nbuenora tweeted at Tom_Hartman. By the way, if you tweet my name, it's not just all run together. It's Tom underscore, you know, that underline, Hartman. Nbuenora, because it says hamburglarism. Perfect for the fast food industry. Top Shtick says, hello, Tom. Savage capitalism, or terrorists believe in what they're doing as well. Excellent point, by the way. I said earlier, you know, these Tea Partiers actually believe in what they're doing. You're right. Terrorists do, too. Let's see. Jaysychic, J-A-S-Y-C-H-I-C, Jaysychic, maybe, said siphon off capitalism. Eugene Argent said pimp capitalism, and we're the clientele. Puri 85 said, government subsidized capitalism. Yeah, of course. Corporations that profit at the expense of we the people, corporate greed. Tom R. Gill said, vampire capitalism, welfare capitalism, parasite capitalism, Walmart capitalism, and created a hashtag for each one of them. So I've also had people suggest tapeworm capitalism, entitlement capitalism, vampire capitalism, in the extortionism, Amok Wibber in the chat room says pay half their wages or we'll work these employees to death. Sandalwood says arachno capitalism, as in the spider sucking. Benedict says parasitic capitalism. That was Shano's too. That I love that. Leech capitalism suggests Jules. Cuckold capitalism. Oh, yeah, okay. That from Snorky2K. Cannibalistic capitalism from MD Hess. Primitive accumulation from Benedict. Disaster Capitalism, of course, Naomi Klein. Yeah, okay, there's some great ones, but we got a whole bunch of calls here, so let's just get through these real quick. David in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, David.
Hi. I just wanted to, that guy quoted scripture. I want to point out 1 Timothy 6:10, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil.
Mm.
So that's a good verse to remember. But I would offer my suggestion. I'd like the Reaganhood one. The guy definitely deserves two books, actually.
Yeah.
But I would call it decoupled capitalism or globalist capitalism.
Okay.
And what I mean by decoupled is that our capital markets are no longer in the service of the real, everyday, free market, productive economy that most people live in. And when you read the preamble to the Constitution, it doesn't say anything about, you know, free capital markets or whatever. It talks about, you know, the common good,
right,
justice, tranquility.
General welfare.
So we have a decoupling of our capital markets from the rest of the everyday life and experience that people live in.
Okay. Great suggestion, David. Great suggestion. Thank you very much.
I also want to point out an externality.
Okay.
Right now, with all these guest worker visa programs, I estimate just on the H-1B and L-1 visa that companies get a subsidy of about $18 to $23 billion of cheap foreign labor every year.
Wow.
On just those two programs. Because if you add up the H-1Bs and L-1s,
right,
it's about close to 1 million workers. And if they're paid on average $30,000 less per average than an American would get paid in a free market where only Americans have access to jobs,
right,
that counts up to $18 to $23 billion. I told the senator from Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, I told him this in 2009, and he was shocked at that number when I told him to do the math and add up those numbers of guest workers and multiply by average $30,000 or less,
sure,
than what an American would get paid.
Yeah, that's incredible. David, thank you for sharing that with me. Mark in Erie, Colorado, you have a name for capitalism?
A couple of observations before the name.
We have just a minute.
Yes, sir.
No, I said we have just 1 minute, so quickly.
Okay. Yeah, back in June, Barack Obama put Jason Furman. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
As the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, Furman is a great advocate of the Walmart model. He's quoted as saying that Walmart is nothing short of a miracle for America's poor and working class folks.
Wonderful.
In March, he put Sylvia Matthews Burrell as the head of the Office of Management and Budget. She came from Walmart as a top executive.
Yeah.
So let's not look past Barack Obama.
Well, I'm typically not, Mark. I mean, I voted for him and I support him broadly, but he is not a progressive. He's a middle of the road Democrat, or even a conservative Democrat. But your name for capitalism.
Admit it.
Say what? I can't hear you, Mark. Okay. Mark hung up. Oh, well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. What's your name for Captain? And welcome back. Let's see here. We've got some more names for capitalism suggested. Dan in Stockton, California. Hey, Dan. You have a suggested name for this new kind of Walmart fast food capitalism?
Oh, yes, Tom. I surely do. It's a very simple name. It's rather quite obvious, I would think. I call it murder capitalism.
Ooh, ouch. How so?
Well, hey, it kills people, you know. It kicks them out of their houses and...
Yeah.
Doesn't eat them right or give them health care or anything. How can it's planned, so how can it be anything but murder?
Yeah, yeah. I've referred to it as raw or naked or rough or capitalism, raw capitalism. These are all variations, I suppose, on laissez-faire. But actually, in laissez-faire capitalism, you don't have the government subsidizing the companies. So murder capitalism, interesting name. Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate it. Kathy, watching Free Speech TV in Valparaiso, Indiana. You have a name for capitalism?
Yes. How you doing, Mr. Hartman?
Sure.
I would call it Sokman capitalism. Sokman?
Soakum?
Yep, S-O-A-K.
Yeah.
Soakman? Soakman? But or I had something else I wanted to bring to your attention. There was two things. One, I wanted to tell you real fast that I just read in the Chicago Tribune today that Michelle Obama's vegetable garden is rotting away. Nobody's taking care of it.
Yeah.
And all those people are going hungry. Why don't they let somebody go, you know, from a homeless shelter and pick the vegetables?
Yeah, that was on Drudge yesterday.
Yeah, I don't have internet or anything. That's why I'm always calling you on the phone.
Yeah.
And the second thing, I have a question, because I remember in the early 2000s, there was a young, say, 20-year-old couple coming around our neighborhood. We were fighting our utility company. And the organization they used for people to sign to fight against the high rates of our utility bills was called Citizens United. Now, is this the same Citizens United? Because, that burns me up, because I didn't sign up like the Tea Party.
I don't know. You know, there's a group called Citizens United for Separation of Church and State, which is not the Citizens United that went to the Supreme Court.
That was the last thing I ever wanted to sign, you know, what you're discussing now.
Yeah. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of organizations that have.
Oh, okay. And then I wanted to ask you about Higgins, because I'm an animal lover. I got animals all over the place.
Higgins.
And I'm always worried about your kids.
Higgins was going downhill. I mean, he was just skin and bones, and he was getting worse and worse and worse. And the doctors, basically the vet, after, you know, $1,000 in vet bills and three or four visits, just threw up their hands and said, well, probably he has cancer. And Louise had asked several times, what if we gave him antibiotics? And they said, nah, you know, we're not going to do that. And so 2 days ago, maybe 3 days ago, we had some old doxycycline sitting around from an infection that one of us had a long time ago, a couple of years back. And so Louise figured out the cat dose and titrated it down and put Higgins on doxycycline. And now he's up and he's walking around and he's acting far more normal. He's still acting like an elderly, like he's, you know, he's very old, but he's no longer behaving like he's in pain. And he might be coming back. So it may be that he had an infection. The vet said it didn't show up as white blood cells in his blood. And that's why they didn't want to put him on antibiotics. But it might have been that he had an infection, like, you know, in his gut or something that was, what do you call it? You know, that's still contained, encapsulated. But whatever it is, I'll keep you up to date. Thank you for asking, Kathy. But so far, Higgins is still alive. You know, the cat came back. We thought he was a goner. Thank you, Kathy, for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to save a rescue or help a rescued slave, and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And that photo, in all probability, will have been taken by Ellen herself. She gets over there to South Sudan several times a year, and just got back just a couple of weeks ago. Hi, Ellen.
Well, hi. It looks like there's going to be a vote around 6 o'clock in the Senate. On the budget, the parameters are that the budget would go, there'd be a continuing resolution through January 15th, a default raising the level of the overall ceiling, debt ceiling, till February 7th. Then there is going to be a conference committee chaired by House member Republican Senator Murray, who's Senate budget on the Senate side. Harry Reid was on the floor today, as was Mitch McConnell, saying it was a time of reconciliation, that Congress's most important job was job creation and helping the middle class. I don't know why anybody doesn't talk about poor people. It's always the middle class.
Well, because poor people, by and large, don't vote. That's why the politicians don't talk about them, which is unfortunate. And then on top of that, the politicians do everything they can to make sure the poor people don't vote, by making it hard for them to register. If you don't own a car, you don't have a driver's license. Well, you don't have a driver's license, you can't vote. You know the drill.
And if you're poor and old, you're in real trouble.
Yes, absolutely. But anyhow, but a question, Ellen, about this about this bill. Earlier on, because this thing has been through 16 ways to Sunday iterations, earlier on I had heard that there was going to be a provision in it that said, in the future, if you want to default, if you want to pull the debt ceiling trick, you got to have a two-thirds majority. Or if you want to shut down the government, you've got to have a two-thirds majority. Are either one of those provisions in this bill?
You know, I have not seen the language, and they have not released the language. So
okay.
I'm not sure exactly what's in there, and I'm not sure they're sure exactly what's in there until they get it right before they vote at 6, and then it will go to the House later tonight. So
okay.
They have not released the language.
Okay, so it's not cooked until it's cooked.
Look at it.
It's interesting that the House isn't voting first on this. I mean, that's how things are supposed to go.
The reason the House is not voting first on this is because Ted Cruz promised that he was not going to get in the way of this bill. Now, he had his own little news conference today, and he took off on Obamacare in every way, shape, and form possible. He said there was no relief to seniors, there was no relief to parents, that Washington is not listening to people. The House has listened to people, but the Senate maintains the status quo. Washington has done nothing to provide refuge to people because of Obamacare, and it went on from there.
Wow. So he's complaining that Obamacare doesn't provide a good enough benefit, and therefore we should do away with it? Do I have that right?
He's basically saying, look, middle-class people are going to lose their jobs because of the 29 hours, that people are paying higher premiums. I mean, he went through every,
yeah.
He had letters from constituents saying, I had this constituent that said her premium was going to be lower, that Obama promised you could keep the same plan, but you can't. I mean, he just went on and on and on. And very interesting, I believe it was the Houston Chronicle today, said that they had endorsed him because they thought that he would carry out what Kay Bailey Hutchison had done, but he hadn't done that. So essentially they're pulling back.
Yeah, I read that op-ed. They said, oops, shouldn't have done that. Yep.
So we have that going on. Then Mitch McConnell, by the way, got on the floor. He also went after Obamacare, but said that we are going to preserve the Budget Control Act. Then he said, we've fought government spending. It's declined for 2 years in a row without raising the taxes since 1981. He called Obamacare a stubborn ideological obsession.
Now, the Budget Control Act is the sequester, right?
That's exactly what it is.
Right. So Mitch McConnell went on the floor and bragged about keeping the sequester. I thought the Republicans were running around saying that the sequester was the president's idea.
Oh, well, they are now saying that the Budget Control Act worked.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Jim Nussle, who was a Republican congressman, Republican budget director, he said that sequestration was designed to take the budget off autopilot. And he said it didn't work that way. He also, interestingly enough, he was doing this news conference with Leon Panetta. He said we may have lost an entire generation of public servants because of young people seeing what is going on in Washington and not liking it.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders was making that point on our program in the first hour. He said that, what young, new engineer, graduate, smart, the government hires doctors and lawyers and engineers and, good professionals in addition to people to just, clean the parks. And, who's going to want to go work for the government? And then you get this self-fulfilling prophecy where the conservatives scream the government's broken, then they break it, and then they say, hey, look at the government's broken.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So they also, by the way, interestingly enough, Panetta said that, hey, the Obama budget had work on entitlement reform, but nobody wants to talk about that.
That being,
and Obama had offered up some things.
Right,
and nobody wants to talk
the chain
about
CPI,
what Obama
for example.
Offered up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to talk
about
that.
You and I may not like it, but the point is that he did do that.
Yeah, interesting.
Also, Jay Carney talked about removing threats. He said that he said everything is on the table. He said that that they want to sort of start out anew with negotiations. Everybody was happy with that. Also, if this goes on and people cannot pay their rent in Washington and other agencies are, in other places who work for the government, the agencies are going to offer a credit letter to people's credit. Credit, whoever the creditors are, mortgage people, et cetera, saying they work for the government and they're good for the money, basically.
Hmm. That's
good. They're doing that. A couple other interesting things, and also, by the way, Mike Lee said that he was not going to object to this today either. He was not going to try and get in the way, which
right.
is why originally they were going to start the bill in the House, then go to the Senate. They realized once Cruz and Lee are not going to filibuster, they're going to go right to
it. Right. Lee follows Cruz around like his wingman or his puppet or something. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goats for the old goat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And we will be back. Alan Weissman is going to drop by. He wrote the book, The World Without Us, and he's got a new one out, Countdown. It's amazing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Alan Weissman is with us. He is the formerly wrote this absolutely brilliant book, The World Without Us. And his new critically acclaimed best-selling book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, is out now. And just an extraordinary, thoughtful perspective. Alan, am I pronouncing your name right?
Weissman.
Alan Weissman. Weissman. Yes. Thank you very much. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And tell me, what is our best last hope or last best hope for a future on Earth?
Well, you know, my subtitle ends with a question because that's what I was trying to find out myself. It's very complicated, and I just set the facts out there, and I hope the readers can decide for themselves if it is what I think it is. But basically, at the end of my last book, The World Without Us, I ran into this troubling fact that every 4.5 days we're adding 1 million people to the planet. And I'd really written that book because I want a world with us and sort of try to clear everything away, you know, clear us away so we could see how nature would restore itself so beautifully and then see if we could add ourselves back to the picture. But those kinds of numbers are unsustainable. So in this book, Countdown, I look to see if we can determine how many people can fit on this planet without tipping it over. And if so, is there something that we can do about that that is acceptable to the wide range of the world's cultures and religions and political systems? You know, nobody really likes the Chinese one-child policy, including the Chinese. I spent a month there. In fact, I went to 21 countries for this book. And we all know that most nations and religions started with a mandate to be fruitful and multiply, to become, you know, the biggest and mightiest one around, so they wouldn't get out-competed. But now we're living on a planet that is so full of us, it's beginning to really stress the ecosystem in a way that is potentially causing a lot of trouble for us. And as we keep growing, those problems are only going to grow more severe. So that's what I set out to find. Is there a way that we can bring ourselves back into balance with the rest of nature so we can ensure our own future on this planet, and to do it in such a way that we would find it, you know, most of us on this planet would find this to be acceptable, even something within our belief systems that would accommodate it.
Right. I back in 1996, when I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I remember the stats that we pulled together that at that point in time, we were using about 50% of the net photosynthetic productivity, the NPP, the output of all the plant matter on Earth that, you know, is using photosynthetic. We were using over half of all the fresh water. Is it, has it gotten worse since then?
Yeah, there's more of us here. I mean, you know, we, in the last 12 years, we added another billion people.
Right.
And as someone points out in my book, you know, if you try to count to a billion, it would take you 32 years. People are being added to the planet faster than we can count them.
Right. So what do we do about this?
Well, what I discovered that we can do, and we're already doing it, there's good momentum for this. It just needs to be emphasized and accelerated and made more widely available, is simply giving people the opportunity to decide for themselves how many children they want by making contraception available. And in my book, I talk about the male contraception that's now coming available, as well as female contraception. About 250 million people, women in this world, would like to have it, and they can't get it. Mm-hmm. And to make it available, it's not that expensive. Worldwide, we could do it for about a little over $8 billion a year, which is less money than we were spending per month in Afghanistan and Iraq, we being the United States.
Sure.
One other element, and I go to several countries that show how well this works. If women are given the opportunity to be educated, that pretty much solves the problem right there. Education is the best contraceptive of all. And, you know, for example, Italy, a Catholic country with the Vatican telling them that contraception is a no-no, it also has probably the highest percentage of women with graduate degrees anywhere. And even if a woman just gets through high school, she's deferring her childbearing, and then she's got something interesting and useful and helpful for her family. So if she wants to have children, she generally stops with two or fewer, because you can't exercise that profession if you got, you know, a horde of kids hanging on you.
Right.
This is something that has been effectively used by countries who realized that their population was going to outstrip their opportunity to provide jobs for them. And just keeping women in school, I mean, you know, it's such a wonderful bonus, too, because at the end of it, we get these very, very skilled women who can only enhance society.
I thought it was interesting that I think it was Mitch McConnell, might have been, earlier today, was saying, I'm pretty sure, from the floor of the Senate, was saying that it was a group of women in the Senate who put together the deal that's turning the government back on.
I didn't hear that, but I'm certainly not terribly shocked.
Yeah, I thought, whoa, what a great acknowledgement. It's like it seems that those societies where women have equal power with men or even something close to equal power with men, that population stabilizes. But not just that, quality of life improves.
Absolutely. You know, and you have fewer kids to take care of. Mm-hmm. You can take care of them better.
Right.
You can educate them. You can feed them. In so many poor countries in the world that I visited for this book, there were examples of families getting smaller and suddenly getting healthier.
How do you rebut the folks, and I've had them come on this program, and I end up in a debate with them, who say, Japan, for example, their population is shrinking. It's going to create a demographic crisis. We've got to, you know, we can't have a smaller population. It seems to me like if you've got a smaller population, you know, even if you've got more old people, that tightens up the labor market, which raises the price of labor, which improves both, you know, government income in form of taxes, but also improves standard of living. But
what the economists aren't telling you is that pro-growth economists like big populations because that makes labor cheaper. They can get you know, they can get poor people basically, you know, competing against each other to see who will accept the lowest salary. And that ultimately leads us to more social inequity, which is getting in, us into a lot of the social and economic problems that we're in the first place these days. You know, I spent a lot of time in Japan for this book because they do have a shrinking population owing to the fact that after World War II, their economy was so devastated that they literally had to cut off their baby boom because too many people were dying of starvation. And this was before the birth control pill, so they legalized abortion then. And as a result, you know, many women who didn't want to watch another baby died, you know, took advantage of that. And now there's a much smaller generation taking the place of that old overgrown generation that was so overgrown. Japan invaded Manchuria and started World War II because they needed more room.
Mm-hmm.
So today, yes, a lot of economists in Japan are wringing their hands, but there are also economists who are seeing it from, you know, from the other side. I spent a lot of time with one of them. He's in a very distinguished policy institute, Akihiko Matsutani, and he sees that this is an opportunity for Japan to get down to a realistic level and live within its means, and because, you know, there will gradually be fewer people, demand will lower, so there will be fewer need for working hours, and people will have more leisure time.
Alan Wiseman. Hang on just a second, Alan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Alan Wiseman, his book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure, Tom.
We'll be right back. And welcome back. Let's see here. Howard in Warren, Michigan. Howard, you have a name for this new kind of Walmart, McDonald's capitalism where they get we the people through our tax dollars to keep their employees alive and well-fed, and they get to work them and keep the profit?
Thanks for taking my call, Mr. Herman. Sure. First off, your vault of knowledge, big fan. My name for it is Gilded Age Capitalism.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the Gilded Age, I'm writing this down, the Gilded Age in large part was based on this kind of capitalism in as much as, you know, the whole Industrial Revolution was about dumping externalities, wastes, poisons, toxins and things into the environment and not paying to clean it up. And Abraham Lincoln gave $1 trillion in today's dollars worth of free land to the railroads. I mean, there was just these huge gifts to industry as industry grew, but the railroads in particular. And that built some of the first really, really large fortunes in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s in the United States. So that's an excellent suggestion, Howard. Thank you for the call, and thanks for making it.
Do you mind just say one more thing? I brought it up for just for once. Thank you, because that brought a totally different aspect to my thought process about it. Mine was the corresponding, you know, wage discrepancies, you know,
right,
inequality. So, but thank you so much, and I know you have a lot of callers, Mr. Herman,
yeah,
and thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Howard. I appreciate it. Liz, in West Hollywood, California, you have a name for this kind of capitalism.
Welfare for the rich. I've been calling that for years, because they are getting welfare. And, you know, when Bernie was on, I wanted to ask him why they don't, when the Republicans act crazy, they should act just as crazy. And when they send the budget back with something that's stupid, like stopping Obamacare, then we should send, the Democrats should send back a budget saying, okay, we will cut all oil subsidies for oil drilling.
Or we'd like single-payer health care.
For fracking and if they lease the land, they have to lease the federal land, rather. They have to lease it at a fair market value. And when they leave the place, they have to leave it the way they found it, in a pristine condition.
Yeah, or we would like single-payer health care. Or we want to do away with the trade agreements, or, you know, whatever. There's like, yes, that's an excellent suggestion. Liz, thank you very much. I'm with you on that. Judy, you have, in Oakdale, Connecticut, you have a name for this kind of capitalism.
Yeah, carnivore capitalism.
Carnivore. Ooh, I like that.
And I was thinking also eat the peeps capitalism.
Eat the pizza?
Peeps.
Oh, Peeps. Eat the Peoples. Capitalism. Yeah, eat the Peeps.
And there's a take on that Reagan Hood one. I'm kind of stealing this from that guy, but Ronnie Hood.
Ronnie Hood.
Ronnie Hood capitalism.
Yeah, that takes two steps to understand it, you know, because you have to think of Ronnie. Who's Ronnie? Okay. Oh, yeah, Ronnie Reagan. So I think Reagan Hood still beats that. But that's a good one. Carnivore capitalism. It's eat the Peeps. Excellent. Judy, thank you very much for the call and for the suggestion. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So what do you call this kind of capitalism where this kind of, you know, what Walmart capitalism, I mean, you know, Walmart has popularized it, but it's now spread to the fast food industry. And the fast food industry last year, $7 billion profit. We subsidized them to the tune of $3.8 billion. And this is just the top 10 companies. So we pay to keep their workers alive. We pay it, right? We feed them with food stamps. We house them with housing vouchers. We warm them, keep them warm in the winter with heating assistance. We pay to keep their, and we provide them with medical assistance through Medicare. We keep their workers alive, and then they work the workers and keep the profit from the workers' wages, from the workers' efforts, from the products that the workers make. What do you call that kind of capitalism? Somebody just called and suggested carnivore capitalism. Another person suggested Gilded Age capitalism. Another person suggested welfare for the rich capitalism. Other suggestions we've gotten, tapeworm capitalism, entitlement capitalism, vampire capitalism, Fritonomics, Mucknomics, muck capitalism, Reaganhood capitalism. Decoupled capitalism, global capitalism, SOCOM capitalism. So this is what we have so far as some new Twitter suggestions from Kenneth K. Shep. Necrocapitalism. Ooh, McSlavery says American washout. Microwave pizza says supersized capitalism. Excellent. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Sure. Hey, Tom. Happy hump day. Yeah, my suggestion was corporatism, because, I mean, ultimately it's a rigged system that only benefits the largest corporations, and you're either competing with, wages from slaves in third world countries. If you want to compete against that, then you have to, you know, compete with your lower wages, and, you know, and they get to keep all of the, you know, it's a rigged system. You can't fairly compete against large corporations. They get all the concessions. They get all of the, breaks. If you want to open up a business, you have to jump through, you know, massive amounts of red tape. If you're a corporation, you can just bribe your way into your, you know, into a neighborhood, set up shop and put everyone else out of business. And, you know, you have no other choice but to work for them because there's no other jobs around. So I would call that corporatism.
Okay. Corporatism. Good one, Marty. Thank you very much. Norma in Berkeley, California. You have a name for this kind of, this is the new capitalism?
Yeah, it's capitalism. Tom, you've been talking about capitalism for the past centuries of doing it. People have got to understand that we're in the same place. We're owned by the kings, as we've been for millennia, and we're still servicing them and under different names and semi-different structures. I wanted to tell you.
So should we,
anyway,
Norma?
Norma, should we
then just use the old-fashioned word for it? Call it feudalism?
No, capitalism.
Oh, okay.
This is the crime of capitalism. We have to know.
Oh, you're saying we should simply acknowledge this is how capitalism works.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I wanted to make another couple of comments to you, if it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, your skillfully supportive responses to people who have very few of them have very off-the-wall input, and you're right there with you, helpful, and push it along intelligibly. That's very well appreciated by me, the most intolerant person you've ever heard. And I wanted to mention Mr. Weissman's information about abortion. Appreciated him putting it in the context of how useful it is. That and it's useful to the owner, to our owners. They use the excess amount of population, I hate to call it that, but the numbers of people available to do the work as providing a benefit to our owners in the competition that they give for to keep wages down.
Yeah.
And abortion being such a good choice about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the you have been describing what's going on today. If we ended the owners, we would have socialism for all of us. We'd
yes.
all be taking care of all of us.
Yes, we would be taking care of ourselves. And
the owners would not be making the profit.
There you go. There you go. Excellent point, Norma. Thank you for the call. Very well said. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina.
Hi. Feudalism.
Feudalism?
Feudalism.
How do you spell that?
Feudalism.
How do you spell it?
P-S-E-U-D-A-L-ism.
Ah.
Like feudalism, but it's pseudo, quasi.
Ah, yeah. Okay, feudalism. I like that. Feudalism. Thank you, Tina. That's a good one. Svetlana in Shamamish. How do you say that city in Washington, Svetlana?
Shamamish.
Thank you.
Shamamish.
You have a name for capitalism, for this kind of capitalism?
Yes. Yes, I do. I actually just wanted to kind of allude to what Norma was saying, that capitalism by its nature is best described as a parasitic capitalism or parasitic system of life where some people take advantage of others, and this is how they make money at the expense of others. But I think what you're really looking for is a name for this special kind of capitalism that we're having right now, and I have a name for that.
And that is?
I would call it Ebola capitalism.
Ebola capitalism?
Ebola is a virus, a very rare one. I'm sorry?
No, I'm listening.
Yes, Ebola capitalism.
Right.
And Ebola is a name of a very rare virus that actually kills its host, unlike the other viruses, very
right.
quickly. Because that's the only way it survives.
Right.
And I think this is the name that you're looking for. This is the latest incarnation of parasitic capitalism that we're seeing now that I would call Ebola capitalism.
Ebola capitalism or SARS capitalism or something like that. One of these viruses that destroys its host. Excellent suggestion. Svetlana, thank you for the call. And we'll be back with more of your thoughts for this name for capitalism and other thoughts on the day. And I'll keep you up to date. It looks like the Senate is going to be voting around 6 o'clock tonight. And then the House will vote shortly after that. And then whatever comes out of that, assuming that they're the same piece of legislation, that they're identical, then the president can simply sign it. So we'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Bottom line, after throwing a tantrum that cost our country so far $24 billion and enormous prestige around the world, the teabaggers are fit to pack it in. The bad and the very, very sempervirently ugly, the good. Zach Roberts. Alec has declared war on green energy, and its newest target is Ohio. With the help of a few Republican state lawmakers, the group is trying to push a bill that would gut the Buckeye State's renewable energy standard, a law that forces the state to get a big part of its energy from clean sources like wind and solar. But now Alec has run into a roadblock. 2,000 Ohio veterans, led by National Guard veteran Zach Roberts, have started a campaign to raise awareness about the anti-green energy bill, and they're trying to rally lawmakers against the measure. Republicans are always talking about respecting our veterans, so who knows? Roberts' campaign may be just the thing to keep Ohio green. The bad. Anthony Badalamenti. A former Halliburton manager pleaded guilty yesterday to destroying evidence that could have been used against his company in the investigation of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill. Badalamenti admitted that he ordered one of his co-workers to delete an internal company test of the cement centralizer that Halliburton built for the Deepwater rig. He will now face up to a year in prison and will have a $100,000 fine. Badalamenti is lucky the media is so focused on the shutdown, otherwise more people would probably call him out for what he is, someone who tried to cover up his company's role in the death of 11 workers. And by the way, why isn't the CEO of Halliburton being held accountable too? And the very, very ugly Fox so-called news. On Monday, the so-called news network published what was supposed to be a shocking story on its Fox Nation website. The story was cross-posted from the Daily Mail and said that girls at Florence High School in Colorado have complained to school officials that a transgender student harassed them in the bathroom. It was headlined, "Girls, in quotes, harassed in school bathroom by transgender student told his rights trump their privacy." Sounds pretty bad, right? Not so fast. Florence High School superintendent told an LGBT advocacy magazine that she had been unable to verify the incident. It now appears the whole thing is just one big lie. But Fox doesn't really care. They're perfectly willing to run any fact-free story as long as it fits the network's hateful agenda. And that is very, very ugly. It's really amazing. Hey, we've got a lot of people who have called with names for this new kind of Walmart, McDonald's capitalism where you and I, the taxpayers, pay to keep people alive. You know, because they're paid so little by their employers, in order to be able to eat and sleep and to get medical care, they have to go on the public dole. But the employers get their labor cheap, 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 and then make profits off that labor, because let's keep in mind, corporations wouldn't be profitable if people didn't do things for them. It's the workers who make the money, not the corporation. And they make billions of dollars in profits while you and I subsidize them to the tune of billions of dollars. This McDonald's, Taco Bell, Walmart kind of capitalism, what would you call it? Tom, in Holyoke, Colorado, you have a name for it?
Yes, I would like to call it crapitalism.
Crapitalism. That's just on the edge of something you can't say on the radio. But okay, that's a good one, Tom. Thank you. Charles in Candler, North Carolina. Hey, Charles, you have a name for this capitalism?
Yes, sir, I do. And I think it's short. I'm running out of battery. I would call it parasitic capitalism. And if we look at capitalism as a neutral term, in best possible case scenario, you could have worker-oriented or cooperative capitalism, which could take the place of socialism. And in worst case, again, we have parasitic capitalism. Again, Standard Oil is doing, you could call it predatory capitalism. Again, look for terms that actually fit what it does. Because a good parasite takes control of its host. Host doesn't know about it and uses the host to an advantage, which is exactly what we have right now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Parasitic capitalism is a very good one. Charles, thank you for that. Robert in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to KABQ. Hey, Robert, you got a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yes, I sure do. The name I'm suggesting is self-destructive capitalism.
Okay. And it's self-destructive why?
Well, I think because of a lot of reasons that you have been given.
It's unsustainable over the long term. Eventually, you end up with everybody so poor that nobody's buying the products that capitalism is making, and the economy collapses. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
That's exactly what will happen if it continues.
I suppose you could call it endgame capitalism then, too, or grab what you can get while it's available capitalism or whatever. But, Robert, thank you. Excellent suggestion. Francine in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Francine, watching on Roku. You have a name for this capitalism?
Yeah, hi, Tom. How about a play on Reagan? How about calling it subsidy queen capitalism?
Subsidy queen capitalism. I like
with
that.
The added bonus, and with the added bonus that these subsidy queens create their own ghettos.
Yeah, yeah, they actually do, sadly. Thank you, Francine. Good one. Rob in Fairfax, California. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, I'll throw in a vote for carcinogenic capitalism.
Carcinogenic. Yeah, cancers, like parasites, eat their hosts and kill their hosts.
They'll go rogue, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, that's a good one, Rob. Thank you. Natalie in Lafayette, Alabama, you have a name for this kind of capitalism.
Yeah, I would like to call it cacodemonic, which means bad demon. Caco means bad, And like, say if you have calligraphy, that means good handwriting. If you have cacography, that means bad handwriting.
Uh-huh, so it starts with a C.
Yeah, I was trying to make words that were like C words with capitalism.
Yeah, cacodemonicism.
Yeah, and if you want to look up just a weird word for just to see, look up cacoethes, which is C-A-C-O-E-T-H-E-S, which is like wicked plus ethos.
Huh.
That is a great word, but it doesn't fit in with our bumper sticker.
Right, right.
Thing.
Okay, well, it's a good shot. That's a good one. Natalie, thank you for the call. Sohaila in Seattle, Washington, you have a suggestion?
Thank you for your great program. Hey, since supposedly before Reagan it was all very popular capitalism, and now with all these nuances, lovely ones, how about unpopular capitalism?
Unpopular. That's an excellent one. You know, it just occurred to me, you mentioned Reagan. George Herbert Walker Bush called it voodoo economics, voodoo capitalism. I mean, that's a possibility. Thank you, Sohaila. I appreciate that. Stephen in Littleton, New Hampshire. Hey, Stephen. I've been to Littleton. It's a great town.
Okay. How about instead of venture capitalism, vulture capitalism?
Vulture capitalism is an excellent one. They just pick the bones clean, and then when there's no more bones, they move on. Excellent one. Thank you, Stephen. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. You have a name for this capitalism?
Futilism, F-U-T-I-L.
Ah.
No matter how hard you try, you will not get ahead.
Right. And it's also a play on feudalism. That's an excellent one. Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Gene in Columbia Station, Ohio. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yes. Trickle up.
Aha. Trickle up.
Yes.
Yep.
That's what we have.
There you go. Excellent one. Thank you very much. Kirk in Bothell, Washington. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Holonomics, Tom.
Say that again?
Holonomics.
As in hollowed out?
Yes.
Holonomics. Okay, that's a good one, Kirk. Thank you very much. We're collecting some really cool names here. Robert in Great Court, South Carolina. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Wild boar capitalism. They devour everything.
Wild boar. Ha! This is great. We got tapeworms, vampires, wild boars, freedonomics. Carnivores, this is great stuff. Thank you very much, Robert, for that. Paul in Minneapolis, listening on AM 950, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
You talking to me?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I got, let's keep it real simple here. How about FU capitalism?
Yeah, that's, again, we're dancing around the edge of what you can't say on the radio, but that's... Okay, Eric in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You got a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yes, yeah, since we're getting close to the holidays, how about Scroogealism?
Scroogealism! I love that.
Okay. As,
and it really is, by the way, because Ebenezer Scrooge, I-L-I-S-M, I write this down. Ebenezer Scrooge was actually the middle class in Dickens' time. You know, he was a small businessman who had one employee. He had a little tiny company. And... most everybody was Bob Cratchit. You know, 99% of all the people were just dirt poor. So, yeah, excellent. Scroogealism. I love it. Thank you, Eric. John in Seattle, listening on KBCS. John, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
I do. I'd like to call it cannibalistic capitalism. It eats everything. It eats what it's got in itself. It eats its employees. It eats the environment. It eats governments around it. It'll take what it needs. I like the boar also. I think that's great. Or vulture. But cannibal, let's get at what they actually do.
Cannibal capitalism. And, you know, a variation on that might be zombie capitalism, too. You know, it's just, well, maybe not. I don't know. You can't kill it, but it is dead. But it's not dead. But, you know, but it is a person, according to the Supreme Court. Right, yeah. And Anthony Scalia will tell you it is a person. John, thank you for that. Excellent suggestion. Out of Seattle. Oh, we only have 10 seconds. I don't have enough time to... we'll be back with more of your suggested names for capitalism in just a minute. But so far, and Twitter suggestions, the most recent ones, necrocapitalism, McSlavery, and supersized capitalism. That from Kenneth K. Shep at American Washout Microwave Pizza, or at in front of each one. McNomics, Reaganhood capitalism, carnivore capitalism, Gilded Age capitalism, welfare for the rich capitalism. Scroogelism. I love that. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what do you call an economic and political system, I guess, basically, or an economic system that depends on the taxpayers to subsidize the corporations? Welcome back. Okay, let's pick up some more here. Gloria in Lumberbridge, North Carolina. Hey, Gloria, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just fine.
Those names everyone's coming up with, they are wonderful. I wanted to make a comment about the what you're saying with the capitalistic system.
Mm-hmm.
I live in North Carolina, and you know we're going through some real rough stuff here. And a couple weeks ago, I watched a short documentary that was given on one of the local TV stations. And, you know, they are doing these little things, trying to make people see that, oh, we're doing everything for the good, like cutting unemployment and food stamps and so forth and so on. And there was one gentleman, he was called himself a businessman. He say he owned a pest control company. And one of the things they're doing in North Carolina is raising the unemployment tax they have to pay in order to cover the federal money they got a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, yeah, he'd be willing to pay that if this is supposed to happen over 2 years. He's willing to pay that. He said he can hold down his hiring right now. He said, but we need to cut this stuff because he'll hire after he gets through paying these taxes. And he said, the reason I know that I can will hire then is because the people will take whatever I offer them to pay them.
Right.
That was his exact words.
Which is a comment on how bad our economy is, and also how important it is, frankly, that the government be the employer of last resort. This is something that we stopped doing after the Roosevelt administration, making, you know, during times of high unemployment, having the government, be the employer of last resort. So, you know, with the CCC and the WPA and things like that, which reduces the unemployment level. And as you reduce the unemployment level and the labor market tightens up, people are no longer willing to work for whatever people are offering. People will only work for a decent wage because they know that there's lots of jobs out there. And so what he's describing is this loose job market that we have right now, which is the result of 32 years of Reaganomics.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And when he said that, it was just like a kick in the stomach.
Yeah.
You look around and you have so many people out of work, and the unemployment rate is ticking up in North Carolina. So
yep.
I guess he'll have his choice then.
Yeah, I guess so. We need to change our trade policies. We need to bring our jobs back home. We need to stop issuing so many visas for foreign workers to come in here and work for half the wages of Americans. We have to educate people without throwing them into debt. We need to provide free college education and trade school education. And the unions used to participate in doing that. It used to work out really, really well. There's just so many things that we should be doing just step by step, and we're missing out on all of them. Gloria, thank you for the call, and thank you for very interesting comment that this guy just came right out. By the way, you know, Tom DeLay used to own a bug extermination company. Tom DeLay was a bug exterminator, an insect exterminator. And then he became a felon, and now he's not. So, yeah, go figure. Anyhow, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before. Kind of capitalism that we have in America with these giant corporations, whether it's the fast food industry or the big box industry, where they pay their workers so little that their workers, in order to survive, have to go on public assistance, have to get a food stamps and housing vouchers and heating assistance and things like that. And so in the case of this new study out, in the case of the fast food industry, they make $7 billion. They've got all kinds of executives who are making hundreds of millions of dollars. But we subsidized them to the tune of $3.8 billion last year. $3.8 billion. What do you call that kind of capitalism? Michael in Dublin, Virginia, you have a name for it?
Yes, I do. You know, Tom, having that amount of power requires a lot of discipline. And since they control the flow of currency, I think that we should name it the CCA. In other words, CCA standing for Current Corporate Authority.
Okay, the Current Corporate Authority. You got it. Michael, thank you very much. That's a good one. Larry in San Saba, Texas. Do you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, Tom. How about sweatshop capitalism?
Of course. That's an excellent one. Sweatshop capitalism. Thank you for that, Larry. Greg in Spring Creek, Pennsylvania. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Oh, yes, I do. It's called corriminalism.
Corriminalism. What is it? What does corriminal mean?
I don't know. It just kind of rhymed, and it sounded pretty good when I...
Okay, as in corporate and criminal and kind of merging all that stuff together?
Yes.
Okay, I get it. I get it. Great one, Greg. Thank you very much. Justin in San Luis Obispo, California. You have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I do have a name. Bro capitalism.
Rogue?
Bro.
R-O-W?
No, bro. B-R-O.
Oh, B-R-O. Why that?
The jock or like very chauvinistic bro type at your high school.
Okay.
Yeah, like a bro.
I got it.
Of capitalism.
Okay, Justin, excellent suggestion. Thank you. Rob in Sacramento, California, listening on AM 1160. You have a suggestion?
How about self-immolation capitalism?
Setting yourself on fire.
Our own house.
Self-immolation capitalism. That's a good one. Rob, thank you very much for sharing that. Kathy in Lincolnshire, Illinois, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Hi, Tom. Love your show. I call it socialized capitalism.
Socialized capitalism.
Because we privatize profits while we socialize the costs and the risks.
Yeah, well, that's actually very common sense. It wouldn't make such a good bumper sticker, but that's an excellent suggestion. It's a very, very, you're right, and it's true. You're absolutely right, Kathy. Thank you. Jules in Desert Hot Springs, California. You've got a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, Tom, I do. It's called Making Money Off of Human Suffering Capitalism.
Okay, Making Money Off Human Suffering. Now we got to figure out how to turn that into one word. That's a great start, Jules. Thank you very much. Kevin in Cambridge, Mass., you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, Tom, I've got a name I've been using since college. I call it gangster oligarchy.
Gangster oligarchy. Excellent, excellent. It's true, too. Claude in Monroe, New York, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thanks.
I call it outdated. It's time for the American people to wake up and start forming worker cooperatives so we can take charge of our own economy.
I am totally with you, Claude. That's an excellent suggestion. Thank you very much. Dave in Chicago, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
I do. I'm surprised nobody said it yet. Capitalism.
Spell it? No, maybe don't. Oh, yeah, okay. Got it. Okay, Dave. Yeah, that's again, we're dancing up against the edge of what you can say on the radio. Bob in Chicago. Hey, Bob, you've got a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, I think we're kind of going towards a governmental capitalism, like government capitalism.
Government capitalism, yeah, or government-subsidized capitalism is actually literally what I'm describing here. The government gave these companies $3.8 billion in subsidizing their employees, and then the companies took $7 billion in profits and, you know, gave it to their rich people. Excellent point, Bob. Thank you. Roy in St. Louis, Missouri, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to compliment you on what a good program you have.
Thank you.
And I have renamed you in a good way. I call you Tom Man with Heart.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoy that because it's real. I mean,
well, thank you. I take it seriously.
Make a real point, and I'll give you my little cutesy. Okay. I'd like to say that, and I know you're aware of this. I guess I want to give this to the other people who are listening. Do you know who the poorest man in all tribes were, the Indians?
No.
The chief.
The poorest man was the chief. Yeah, I know that the chief had the least power in most tribes.
No, he had the least possessions as well. Because anytime things got bad, he gave it all to them.
Right. Right. These are called obligation societies where you gain status by giving things away. And literally, like Jesus said, the least is first.
If you gave it all away, you gained all vote of the tribe.
Yeah, there you go.
If you would not give it all away, he lost.
No, I got it. But I've got a whole bunch of people who have names for capitalism, and I only have a minute left. So let's quickly, your name, Roy?
Two kind of units. The people that use and the people that give.
Okay.
There's no in between.
Got it. Tim, in New York, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Kamikaze
capitalism. Excellent. Mike in Clifton, New Jersey, name for this kind of capitalism?
Yes, it's Mick for McDonald's and Avarice for extreme greed.
Avarice capitalism. I love it. Pam in Fort Collins, Colorado, name for the capitalism?
I call it predatory capitalism. I don't know if you've seen those nature shows with those big sardines.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Excellent, Pam. Predatory capitalism. Love it. Robert in Seattle, you have a name for this kind of capitalism?
Yes. Let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake. Marie Antoinetteism. That's a good one. Phil, I don't have a city for you, Phil.
Yeah, I have a name for it, Tom. Let's call it what it is. It's fascism. Only in this case, it's crypto-fascism because nobody seems to recognize that we're living under a fascist regime.
Well, it is because it's the merger of state and corporate interests. Michael in Chesterton, Indiana. You're the last one here. You got a name for capitalism?
Yeah, cannibal capitalism.
Cannibal capitalism. Okay, great. We're out of time. Call back tomorrow. We'll get some more names in here. I know we've got a bunch of people still on the board. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, the latest on the debt deal, how the House responds. We'll be wrapping it up. Plus, Mike Papantonio is going to drop by. He always has some interesting opinions. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, and we've got to save the world. Right? Seriously. Get over to lasthours.org. Watch the video. Facebook it. Friend it. Tweet it. Tell your friends, tag, you're it, lasthours.org.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.